Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free Urbanism.
Hello and welcome back to Radio Free Urbanism. My co-hosts might be wondering why I was waiting an extra second, and it's because last time we had a bit of a delay on some of the audio, so I'm waiting for all the red lights on everybody's things to turn on. But we are back. My name is Alex Williams, and today I'm here with three co-hosts. I'm going to introduce our regulars first. That's Ethan Myers.
Hello, people. I'm back.
And Nick Laporte.
Hello.
And of course, we're also joined by Sammy from Untitled Planning. Hi, Sammy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We're super stoked to have you. We're kind of on a roll of having guests on the show right now, and it's bringing some interesting perspectives to the podcast. So we're going to start off. We want to hear, what is Untitled Planning, and from what perspective are you coming at urbanism?
Untitled Planning is a twofold platform. It's a multimedia platform in one of the folds, and in the other, it's a research consulting kind of thing that we're doing. And when it comes to the multimedia kind of platform, we kind of focus on knowledge base action mobilization, meaning we want to create knowledge that can be taken by the person that's listening and be a part of the community in creating change. There's a lot of amazing information out there, but sometimes people don't know what to do with it. And so we kind of want to talk with either professionals within the field, professors, community developers, economic community organizations and whatnot, and kind of see where they're at, how people can interact with them. Because we think there's like a lack of understanding overall that people can actually hit up their community organization that's working on like a workforce development project or this and that and see how they can be involved. Or maybe just understand what's going on. Because often they're like, what is this new development and why has no one told me about this? And, you know, as simple as like you can attend your council meetings, which I like a lot of people should if they're upset about a project or if they're just interested on what's happening in their city. So that's kind of the approach we're taking. A bit about myself, I guess. I just graduated from U of T. Well, it's been a year now, but I just graduated last year from U of T, master's in planning, urban planning, main focus, community economic development and housing. Did my undergrad in geography and sustainability. I've lived in like six different cities.
That's sweet.
Five.
So you're
cities.
Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. You're a legit professional. You know this stuff. So it's going to be cool to kind of hear some of your perspectives on the show and talk about these stories with you. I wonder, you mentioned you've lived in six different cities. Before we continue on to the rest of our updates here, what cities have you lived in?
I was born in Syria, Damascus.
Okay.
I was there for like maybe 8 months before my parents were like, we're about to head out. But I used to visit like every year for like multiple months at a time, right before the war happened. And then I haven't been back since. And then I lived in Muscat, Oman. So I lived in Oman. My dad lived in Qatar, Doha. He was a professor there. And so I would go and stay with him a bit at a time. And then Saudi Arabia a little bit. I was too young though, but I lived there, so I'm claiming it.
And then
London, Ontario, as my young childhood, then Hamilton for my undergrad, Toronto for, my grad school. And then I guess if you want, count Kamoka as a tiny village outside of London.
Let's count it.
Rural Ontario.
That's cool.
A little rural city, then
That's cool. That's got to give you some interesting perspectives on cities and stuff. So we'll get more into that as we go throughout the show. Before I move things off to Nick, do you guys have any burning questions you must know from Sammy right now?
Are we got time later to ask, you know, questions about, we can actually dig into stuff? Is that what you're saying? Okay, then I'll hold off. I got one.
Okay. Well, Nick, I'll let you take it away with a quick comment here.
Yeah, we got a comment from one of our patrons, Austin Serson, about perks. And he says, maybe a perk of Patreon could be a live stream of the podcast. Audio as it's being recorded might help grow the Patreon, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, this is actually an option because we're using a certain platform to record this right now. And it has that audience function. So I think we're going to add that as a perk. So if you want to join Patreon. That'll be a perk that we'll add in the near future that you can listen to the podcast. Actually, we think you can watch it live and even join in if we invite you on.
So that'd be cool, actually.
Yeah, and then maybe we could take live questions, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we have a lot of ideas for some bonus shows and additional content. And we've got some planned already, but doing live shows on Patreon.
Stay tuned, folks.
Especially cool.
Yeah, so check it out. It's Radio Free Urbanism on Patreon.
Also, Austin desperately wants the Patreon to grow because I think he's very lonely over there.
Come on, folks.
Just hanging out. I think there's one other person with Austin, but he's the only one who comments on things. And so maybe that's something we can work on. But of course, Ethan's back. Ethan.
Oh, also not to mention, as a perk for the Patreon, you can watch these pretty much as soon as they come out, too. So even if you don't want to watch live, you can always watch almost immediately after. But regardless, hi, folks. I'm back. I took a little break last week, but I'm back here. Welcome back to the show. And also, I have a little what grinds my gears here. Just a quick little one. My local bus that I would love to frequent, and I love taking it to work, is getting rerouted away from my house. So, folks, this is just a quick thing to pay attention to civic engagement and stuff like that, because it's actually coming as part of a road diet to a street that's actually just up the road from me, where they're adding some modal filters to not make it a through street. So it's kind of the double-edged sword of urbanism sometimes, but... yeah, that's just a little what grinds my gears.
Yeah, that would be gear grinding. and we're glad to have you back with us.
And now it's time to grind the gears on commuting on my e-bike. But great to be back, guys. Yeah, I'm being forced into micromobility by Nick. This is purely what's happening.
I definitely am pulling the strings down there.
Yeah, it's all one big conspiracy. Nick just wants everyone on an e-bike. Don't trust him, people. Just kidding.
Many
e-bikes
such cases.
Are the best. Yeah. Okay. So I've got a little update here. I've been talking about the RCG upzoning that is hopefully going to happen in Calgary, April 22nd, 2024. That is the date of the public hearing. If you are in Calgary, please come out to that. If you're not comfortable speaking in front of council, there are other ways that you can help. Send me a message on Instagram at Humane Cities. And I will help you get set up. I'll give you the links and make sure you know how you can help us kind of build a more resilient city. As another update, though, we've got a couple good news here. So for the RCG upzoning again, an organization of a bunch of people organizations, including the Calgary Food Bank, the Women's Center of Calgary, the Alex Community Health Center, Prospect Human Services, the Drop-In Center. All these organizations have signed an open letter together to get the city council on board with upzoning. And then as a last little update from me here, the federal government of Canada has offered $23 million to build two new apartment complexes in Calgary, specifically supporting women and children. So this is some new affordable housing that will be coming to the city, and that's 64 units. Before we go on, I just want to check on our friend Sammy here.
I've got one update I want to share, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah.
Our very own Alex Williams, dripping on the front of Calgary Sun in his trapper hat. So this guy right here on our podcast made the Calgary Sun, his beautiful face, standing outside of a bus stop. Acadia resident ditches car to embrace public transit, walking and wheeling. And a quote from our very own, "We need more options, and I'm trying to promote having that accessibility and that freedom to make use of a variety of options." Beautiful read. Go check it out in the Calgary Sun.
I almost forgot about this.
And leave a positive comment too, folks.
Yeah.
There's
please
too many
leave a positive
in there.
Comment. People
doomers.
Are mean.
I wouldn't even call them doomers. I'd just call them
straight up detractors.
They're not just saying transit is impossible. They're just saying they don't like it.
Yeah.
And they think Alex's lifestyle is woke, as you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's definitely woke to take the bus.
Somebody said. I bet he's also vegan. which is funny because the day it was published, I had like the biggest beef burrito I've ever eaten in my life.
God, and
I don't usually eat meat. I actually don't usually eat meat, but it just so happened the day that I read that comment.
Oh my God.
I had eaten a lot.
It's so on the nose.
Yeah, here I'll share the screen so that we can see this here. There's me, Calgary Herald. It was also published in the Calgary Sun, like Nick mentioned. And here are all the comments. They pinned this comment, each to their own. If you can do it, do it. But don't expect everyone else to be forced to follow too, because this simply would not work for my family. And I did say in the article too, I made sure that I noted that I'm like not expecting anybody else to get rid of their car. I think that's a ridiculous ask to.
It's okay though. Everybody thinks that you want everybody to go car free forever and ever, and that they need to all follow your life and exactly be Alex Williams, except it's they true. Also need to go vegan, yeah. And they also need to live in an 80 square foot pod.
Yeah, if you
and they also need to live in my mother's basement.
Yeah, you're gonna be in a 50 minute city, and you're gonna like it.
Yeah,
you're going to be monitored forever and ever. There's no way around it. This is literally 1984. You have no choice.
1984, 2024. I don't know.
Coincidence?
Seems pretty similar.
Yep.
Damn you, Alex! Right. How could you take all the WEF money?
I know. Hey, you know what? Guy's gotta eat his beans and rice. Okay.
Or a big beef burrito. You know.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
he'd never actually eat a big beef burrito. This guy's clearly a vegan.
Yes. So I'm going to let Nick take us away on our first story of the day.
All right. Well, this is coming from San Francisco. I had like three different ones to choose from. This one I chose. So anyway, the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission is making a new push to electrify transportation in a clean, renewable, and affordable way. And how they're doing that is offering a $1,000 rebate to eligible customers towards the purchase of an electric bike at participating locations, which is huge. So they've made very specific provisions to actually get this. And what they are here, eligible customers. And it says that you must be a Clean Power SF or Hetchy Power residential customer in San Francisco. And within their own program, you have to be part of their equity priority community. So they don't specify what that low income threshold is. And I haven't been able to find that information, but they have their own, thresholds within their system, and it doesn't matter. The point is, this is great. They're following suit with a ton of other cities that have done this. Here in Vancouver, we've done it. I know they've done it in Denver. A handful of cities in North America have done this already, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. It's just sad that this isn't coming from higher up in a lot of places, considering how many subsidies we give to electric cars and how mm-hmm. huge those subsidies are. So just to offer, like, for example, $1,000 here for some people in San Francisco, that's huge. That could be half of a pretty good electric bike. That's a pretty good chunk. In Vancouver, I think it was maximum $1,200, but it was as low as like $200 to $400, depending on your income. And it's just too bad that a lot of these are just for a while. This is just like a 90-day trial. They're going to be giving out up to $1 million in San Francisco. And I think they have like 90 days to actually claim this, and only at very specific retailers. And they've listed them. I'm not going to list them here, but there's like half a dozen retailers that you can get a bike and actually get a rebate. So yeah, I think that's great.
E-bikes are really a game changer. I love that Ethan just popped back on the screen, but he was upside down.
Don't worry. Don't worry about it.
We're having some webcam problems today.
We are absolutely having some webcam problems. I'm back.
There we go. Here's Ethan. Okay. Okay. So you talk about e-bikes. I just watched the Simon Clark video the other day. I don't know if anybody else is familiar or subscribed to Simon Clark, but he's a climate YouTuber. And he made a video called "How Bad Are Electric Bikes for the Environment?"
Oh, I gotta see that.
Yeah, and the conclusion is, in fact, they're better than walking. They're like they're fantastic for the environment. They're quick, efficient, they're clean. I mean, a lot of people, when we talk about electric cars, we talk about the e-waste and the mining of the materials and stuff. But you got to remember, like, half of the battery of an electric car is just to haul the other half of the battery.
Yeah.
Because it's so much heavier, right? You're working with so much more equipment and metal, whereas an e-bike, the battery is a lot smaller, and it's hauling a lot less, and it's doing shorter trips, so it doesn't need, like, it doesn't need to go as far, and so its impact on the environment is significantly reduced, and the benefits that come from the the safety improvements, the health improvements, the wear and tear on our infrastructure, right? Those are all huge as
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something, so like if you think of a Ford F-150 Lightning, so those big electric pickup trucks, I think one of those, just in materials and battery materials, is equivalent to like 150 to 200 e-bikes.
Yeah.
Like it's pretty incredible. You know, you can move, you can move 1 to 5 people, or you can move, you know, almost 200, actually more than that, because you could fit, you know, 2 or 3 people on a lot of e-bikes.
Yeah.
So it's the difference is incredible. But what I really like about this is in San Francisco, because if you haven't been there, you've obviously seen the pictures and the videos. It is incredibly steep. Some of the hills they have there, it is unbelievable. And I think I talked about it on the podcast before, but I had revisited San Francisco not that long ago, and I forgot just how steep a lot of those hills were. And trying to take them on an acoustic bike, I wouldn't be able to do it. Like, there's no way. I would fail. Like going up Steiner Street, like that famous street from like Mrs. Doubtfire, it's not happening. You're not going to be able to do it. So even on an e-bike, I rented an e-bike for the day, and some of the hills, it was like, I can't do it. And I'm like, you can do it. And you just like barely make it up these hills. And I'm huffing and puffing. Yeah.
And then there's also the issue of going down the hills as well, too, because you'll be burning through your brake pads like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So these super helpful to have in San Francisco as an e-bike.
Yeah. Yeah. Sammy, what's your e-bike experience like? You got a philosophy on these things?
Yeah. In the city of Toronto, I know they made a claim about a year ago. They were like, all city bikes are going to become e-bikes. That, in fact, did not happen. But to be fair, it was like a post I saw on Instagram. And then, but I think they increased the amount of e-bikes they had. And some of my friends that have lived in Toronto for a while would give me big, grief is the word. Would give me grief for considering I'm going to use the e-bike if it's available. And they're like, man, that's for people that need it. It's like, just use a normal manual bike. But I think with e-bikes, they're interesting because at least in the city, like if it's like provided by the city, they're always out of battery. Like always. I'm like, who's using these bikes? I'm like, it's 7 a.m. I'm trying to commute to school or work or something. Like, who's these? Like, why, you know?
You know.
Are they docked?
Yeah, they're docked.
They're docked, but the problem is they don't charge them at the docks. And this is an infrastructure problem because they do have them available. I remember seeing at Micromobility America, a lot of these companies offering new ways to have docks that can also charge the bike automatically. Right. But yeah, most places they manually change the batteries by hand.
Oh.
Yeah. I haven't run into the issue of a whole bunch of dead e-bikes yet, but I'm sure I'm going to eventually run into that. But
go to New York City.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah. One city I found that did a really good job of changing out their bikes was Portland. Their whole fleet is e-bikes, but I almost never went to a rack where there was like a dead e-bike. There might be like one or two, but like at a station, when there's like 12, if one or two are dead, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Portland, it was very good because like, again, everything is electrified. All those bikes are electric. And
yeah,
I never had a problem when I was there. But so Sammy, what do you think about the Toronto bike program in general?
In what way?
Do you like it?
Oh. I used it. I used it for 2 years.
Oh, please put this on the website.
I used it. Praise or
beats walking.
Yeah. I think it's like it can be better. It can be more maintained, some of these bikes. I feel like it does beat walking when Toronto is like has really weird public transit. And, you know, it's like one area can take you distance wise, might take you like 10 minutes if you hop on the subway, on the 2-line subway that they have, if you get there. And but then if it's just north, if the bus isn't running, it's going to take you like 45 minutes, even though it's like a shorter distance to walk there. And so taking the bike and just biking down hills is nice. but like I would say 75% of my experience, all the bikes needed to be maintained. You know, a little flat.
Yeah.
The brakes aren't working. It's making sound. It's like probably harder to bike than to walk sometimes. But I'm like, I got to commit. Yeah. I'm like, I spent all this time unlocking this bike. I got to commit. I'm just like braking. And so I'm like, oh,
yeah.
takes me 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I've definitely seen my fair share of bike systems that are good and then bike systems that are needing work. one time my city I used to live in called St. Augustine, Florida, had a bike share system. It had it for about 2 years before the company went belly up and their bikes were just sitting there for 8 months and you couldn't unlock them.
Oh, really?
For 8 months, yeah, they just left them. I don't know if you knew the company Bolt, but they like completely pulled out of the city. And I think they completely went belly up, but they left with no notice. And I mean, like, that'll deter any city from getting new micromobility if, you know, companies just pop in and then pop out within 2 years.
Yeah. That makes it rough. I mean, Sammy, you said that it beats walking, but the way you described it, I'm not so sure. that's like, it sounds like it's really important to, when you're planning a bike share system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love personal e-bikes. I think that's great because it's your vehicle, mm-hmm. right? And it makes it super easy. You bring it home with you. It gets you wherever. But I also think ride shares are a really important part of any transit system, or like whether bike share or scooter or whatever, because it fills in those gaps, like what you're talking about, where the bus didn't quite do what you needed it to do, but the bike could fill in that gap. I think stuff like that's really important, but obviously, like, we got to do it right, man.
Yeah.
That's pretty disappointing.
I'll give Toronto its props a bit, because the 2 years I was in Toronto, I think they made pretty significant biking improvements with, like, biking infrastructure. They, like, started making, they didn't add or change much, but what I noticed, or maybe I became more aware of it when speaking to more bike, because when I first came to Toronto, I come from London. It's, if you want a bike in London, it's almost a death wish if you're not like a proficient city biker, I guess. But in Toronto, when I first came there, it was like a few bike lanes I was aware about. And then the more time I spent there, the more street-based lanes they created. So like it's a full street dedicated to bikes, and they would just have a massive bike sign on the street between neighborhoods and stuff. And that's something I think they added during COVID, which was a huge improvement because it made biking so much safer and faster. I'll give them props because like it kind of mitigated the mediocre biking experience because at least
Right. So we're getting there.
Yeah.
And to be fair, like Toronto Bike is pretty old too. Yeah. And they were one of the first cities in North America to start, you know, putting bike shares all over the place, but they're antiquated and it's time to upgrade. They got like the buttons are on the dock, aren't they? And you have to press like there's 1, 2, and 3 and whatever combination to unlock the bike.
Now they do it through the phone if you have the app, and the barcode and you can scan it.
Can you still go the old way of getting the paper ticket printed and then you got to punch in the number?
Oh God.
I think so.
That's how Chicago's bike share called Divvy was like for probably up until about like 2018.
Really?
Yeah, and then it did app integration, and it's not great there, but it's definitely better than it was.
Thank goodness everyone has phones now. Okay, let's move on to Sammy's story. We've talked about some infrastructure, and we're going to talk about some more here. So Sammy, I'll let you take this story away here.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm sure by now, most people listening, hopefully they've heard about the Baltimore bridge collapsing after a massive cargo ship rammed into it, which kind of re-raised the question surrounding the state of good repair, I think. The article that I found stated that approximately 1 in 3 U.S. bridges require repairs or replacements, emphasizing the urgent need for long-term investment in innovative solutions to ensure bridge safety and longevity. I'm not from the States, but this isn't the...
Ethan's a resident American.
Yeah, I am the resident American. But one thing I will say is that a lot of this like infrastructure talk is It's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no bad infrastructure talk when it comes to bringing up, like, a lot of the, like, derelict infrastructure in the U.S. that needs repair, because a lot of bridges across the U.S. do need repair. Mm-hmm. However, this incident is completely different. This is almost more of a maritime infrastructure thing, because this bridge did not fall apart because of the actual infrastructure not being maintained. The problem with the bridge is that it didn't have the safety features that a lot of bridges should have had. And a lot of this comes down to the ship having some tragic incidents of power failure right before colliding with the bridge. And if you really wanted to prevent incidents like that, doing things like armoring the bridge or placing these little pylons in the, well, not little pylons, but these giant concrete pylons called, they're nicknamed dolphins, but you put them in front of the bridge, like in front of the bridge base. So that way, if there is a collision with a ship, it hits the dolphin rather than hitting the bridge itself. So rather than thinking of this as like the infrastructure is collapsing in on itself, you have to remember container ships are massive.
Huge.
These are hundreds of thousands. These are massive ships, and any bridge that's not protected is going to fall apart. But the real issue is that we just didn't armor the bridge. And I mean, it's definitely something to bring up an infrastructure talking point. But I think a lot of people talking about this bridge being derelict or like, you know, not having, not being updated in terms of like its like structural integrity really isn't the reason as to why this bridge fell apart, when a lot of people are bringing that up as a point.
I agree. I don't think even the article mentioned, and they interviewed specific civil engineers, bridge professionals, and they were all saying it was almost, there's nothing that you could have really done with a huge cargo ship nose diving into into a bridge. But I think it does just raises that awareness once again that's needed on infrastructure in general. Because in Toronto, for example, and this is a conversation we had with a professor on our channel, he's really passionate about, from my previous conversations and even that conversation we had, about poor public housing infrastructure, where that would just collapse on poor public housing, affordable public housing. So historically in Toronto, there was a bunch of affordable housing developed. And then instead of maintaining and improving and expanding on this already established affordable housing, what happens is they're more concerned about ribbon cutting, right? Because it's like, hey, we made more affordable housing. Not, hey, we have enough affordable housing. We have enough of housing that we can convert to affordable housing. And so they kind of forget about this affordable housing that was developed in like 1965 or 1970 or 1980. And now people are getting crushed by like falling apart housing infrastructure. I think, but even with this bridge, that fact that there's one in three bridges in the States that need to be fixed or repaired or like improved upon. I don't know. How many movies have I seen about people in the car in the bridge tunnel and then it collapses and then cannibalism happens? You know, it's like, how far is too far, you know?
I will say, though, as well, on top of this, there was just $1 trillion passed for infrastructure in the U.S. So, and one major point of that bill was actually to fix a lot of the bridges around the country. This bridge is not going to take funding from that. It's going to use like federal emergency money to rebuild the bridge, from my understanding. But a lot of other bridges are either going to get completely replaced or massive overhauls to them from this massive amount of money that's been put into it.
So I imagine, even though this bridge didn't collapse because it was derelict, it collapsed because a giant ship crashed into it. I imagine it's still a good thing that it's kind of reignited that conversation again. Like, it's kind of just said, hey, you know, we should be thinking about our infrastructure. We should be thinking about how we can make it better. Even though this necessarily wasn't necessarily an issue with that.
Do you agree? Yeah. I think there's also with like the rise of technology and like smart cities. And I'm curious if there's going to be like some sort of smart bridge integration of how you can monitor like things a bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
some additional safety precautions and yeah. Yeah.
A lot of this also is with the ship as well too.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember the company that was driving the ship, and I don't want to say any company names just to falsely accuse companies.
Libelous.
But yeah. But it really, from what I heard, it came down to maintenance because, I mean, yeah, this came from a power failure.
Yeah.
When your ship has a power failure, usually that relates to lack of maintenance on board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about the book I just finished reading. I talked about it last week. There are no accidents, and it's those several layers of Swiss cheese. The holes had to line up for all of this to happen. But I think the biggest thing to think about with this story is not, you know, the ship hitting the bridge and knocking it over, but it's about that infrastructure and how much of our infrastructure needs attention. But more importantly, that when we build infrastructure and we do that ribbon cutting, it's not that this new infrastructure isn't an asset and useful, but that it is actually a liability. So that we have to keep in mind, how much are we building? What are we building? What are we investing in now? And how much is it going to cost us in the future? And I think that's what a lot of urbanism is about, is thinking about, like, if I build a giant highway in a whole city like Houston or something like that, how are we going to be in 30 to 60 years? How is this going to affect the future generations? So that's what I want to see come out of this. Actually, well, think about that stuff.
Like, taking into account too that infinite growth is not a thing, right? Like, it's not a guarantee just because we had more money today than yesterday that tomorrow we'll have more money again. And that's where kind of building these strong towns, right? Building resilient cities and sustainable cities, both from an economic standpoint as well as from environmental standpoints, health standpoints, all of the above. It's important to build a sustainable city. Yeah. Any final thoughts on this story before we pass things off to Ethan?
Yeah, I just, based off what Nick said too, on resilience, a lot of the problems we have in cities, not only in infrastructure, but in almost like social problems or many problems, most of them are preventable. And the reason that they're preventable to such a high degree, it's kind of concerning. It's like really concerning. Like, there's too many examples to think of right now. So like my brain's blanking out, but I know we were just talking to someone that looks at the intersection between neuroscience and like space and place, like how people perceive the space that they're in. Obviously there's a lot of talk right now on like urban isolation, but the amount of preventative measures that could have been put in place rather than trying to set out all these fires that just arise. They're more than aware that these fires probably will arise, but it's like, it's going to happen in 80 years. It's not going to impact us, or it's too much money right now. Why bother? Right. And so,
I appreciate that. Thanks for bringing us that, that story today, Sammy. And Ethan, what's your story?
So, folks, we're going to return to talking about San Francisco, but this time it's not going to be as positive. So you guys may know that San Francisco is a bit infamous for not building enough housing for its residents. This might be a little known fact here, but San Francisco actually tried to make a little change with that. And they actually had this law that was going to essentially allow for upzoning in some of the neighborhoods on the city's west side, which are generally wealthier communities that are closer to the beach. Now, a lot of rich residents opposed this, and they coughed up a bill to basically reject this proposal to change the zoning to allow for more housing. Now, this was initially vetoed by the mayor of San Francisco, but as of yesterday, they overturned her veto on that, thereby meaning that more housing isn't going to be allowed in these West Side neighborhoods.
Wow.
Now, this sounds incredibly shitty, and it kind of is, especially on a local level. But this is California, after all. And one thing that California as a state has been doing has really been clamping down on a lot of the neighborhoods and cities in the state that just have not been wanting to build housing. That's one of their big things that they've been doing at the state level, has been relaxing some developers' laws and allowing for upzoning. So this is likely going to clash with the actual, like, at the state level zoning. And when it comes to municipalities and states clashing, in the US at least, the state level will win. But we'll have to see how just the local level resists any sort of change. A lot of you guys may actually know this, like, whole debate going over basically like a 200-story tower being built on the west end of San Francisco. I'll have to pull up an image of it because it's just, it's so funny. It's so jarring. And like it absolutely like terrified a bunch of this, because this is like one of the most NIMBY heavy communities in the country, of the, like, maybe even the continent, of just not wanting any new housing. And it's also because it's a very, very wealthy part of the country. One of the wealthiest parts in the country, actually, I would even argue. But what are your guys' thoughts on this? I mean, how do you feel about this kind of like zoning war clash that's kind of being prepared in the state of California?
It's happening everywhere, right? This is what we're seeing in city after city. And some places it's going well, some places it's not. It's just too bad that we're, it's, you know, doing this flip-flopping in San Francisco, because it is a beautiful city, but it is a very small city. What is it, like 7 square miles or something? It's like, I don't remember the numbers, but it's pretty small. Like, they can't go anywhere else. They can't, I mean, unless they want to start reclaiming, you know, land in the water. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's a small city. So to see that being struck down is really unfortunate.
So San Francisco is 46.9 square miles.
Okay, so fun fact about that, it's smaller than Denver's airport.
What?
Really?
Yes, Denver's airport is like 54 square miles.
Okay, it's 7 by 7 miles.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild. I didn't realize San Francisco was so small. I guess because it kind of blends in. So this is what they wanted to build?
Was proposed, yeah. They wanted to build this right next to the, zoo that's out there in Golden Gate Park. And this terrified a bunch of the NIMBY types around there that are not really a fan of new housing in their neighborhoods.
I will say, though, this is the real fear that quote unquote NIMBYs have, right? Like, this is if I live in a single family home, if somebody was building a tower beside my house, I'd probably be like, eh. Maybe we can find a better place for that. Yeah, now, like I can't blame them for this, but at the same time, San Francisco has a crisis. We're all going through this housing crisis right now, and this is why it's important to allow for incremental changes in your neighborhood, because this tower is the result of decades and decades and decades of not allowing anything to be built. If you don't want a tower built next to your home, you need to allow for, you know, townhomes next to your home, and maybe a single egress walk-up kind of apartment building next to your home, right? Like, you need to allow for these sorts of options. Otherwise, 30 years from now, these are the options. These towers are the options that will be being proposed, because we failed to act slowly, we will eventually have to act quickly. So that's my rant on why we need to upzone and permit more building styles.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I believe San Francisco, this is like a rough estimate from what I saw, is that there are like 11, there's like one place of housing for every 11 jobs in the city.
Wow.
Is something that I heard, which is insane. I believe that the ratio is a bit better. I mean, it's a lot better in other cities, but San Francisco, by just ratio alone, is probably one of the worst housing crisis cities in North America in general at this point.
Yeah.
It's been bad for a long time. Like, I remember when I was there back in 2014, I think, like a decade ago, and a friend of mine was living there. He just graduated. He was doing computer stuff, working at some company, making good money, but he was living in a house with 5 other people, and he was paying like, $1,000 a month or something. And at the time I was like, what the $1,000 a month for like a room? It was crazy. It hasn't gotten better.
No, it's the Bay Area in general is bad, but San Francisco as a city is like a whole different beast when it comes to it. It actually, I believe housing did kind of like stagnate for a little bit, like rents and stuff like that. But I know that it's been on the rise once again.
Yeah.
Now, if you want a city that's the exact opposite, Austin, Texas, they have not stopped building and rents are actually falling there.
Yeah, I did hear that. I did hear that.
Wow.
So good on Austin. Have you ever been to San Francisco, Sammy?
I have not, but I'm learning a bit too much right now. I'm being a little too shocked. Housing shock right now.
Go
visit.
Wild.
It's still an amazing city.
It's awesome.
Transit-wise, pedestrian-wise, it's great. Yeah. But yeah, housing is kind of its major downfall.
Do you mind?
So,
Sam. Resharing that photo or other renders of that photo? Is that how the actual surrounding environments are like?
Yeah,
it's
very low density area by the beaches.
I don't want.
Yeah, on the west side of the city.
Yeah, I don't want to play devil's advocate, but I don't know if that's the best use of planning.
Like Alex said, it's the pressure that gets released. You know, you release that valve, and that's what's going to happen when you don't allow housing for that long.
Yeah, but even with like the money being, I don't know the area well enough, so I can't really speak on it. But my intuitions tell me there's probably that valve could produce better fruit, if that makes sense.
50
stories
is
like huge waste of money of like construction and like development.
Let me show you the area around development or what they're doing.
Oh, that's crazy.
What?
Imagine
that's crazy.
Imagine if this was like Manhattan levels of like demand. No, like this is most of these homes in this area are over $1 million. Like a vast majority.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's wild.
It is, it's a different beast there. It's housing that needs to be built. And yeah, after decades and decades of not building any housing, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. 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 And I, like Sammy said, this probably isn't the best spot to propose something like that. But when you're so restrictive everywhere else in a city, like that is, it's like, well, we found somewhere that maybe we can get this done. So that's where we're going to push it through. But wow, I didn't realize how just like just single family housing San Francisco is, looking at the map here.
Yeah. A lot of the, on the west side, because this is the west side of the city, a lot of this is like two, maybe three story, like stucco single family. You might get some occasional duplexes or triplexes in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe some smaller low density apartments, but other than that.
Wow. Well, I guess that'll be interesting to see what comes of that and how they continue dealing with that. Any final thoughts before I take it away on my story here?
My question would, do they allow like smaller density, like triplexes, multiplexes, missing middle kind of stuff?
I do believe so. I just think that the thing with San Francisco is that there's just not enough actual like high density housing in the city where there's actually demand as well, to the point where you just get massive developments. Obviously there's more dense parts of San Francisco, but the west side of the city that's had this demand has not gotten up above like three or four stories.
Crazy.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Ethan. I've got a story from the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, the headline from CBC here is: four SAIT students say they may have found a solution to Calgary's damage-prone sidewalks. And I was thinking, as a sidewalk-obsessed person, what damage is happening to these sidewalks? Because I've walked on sidewalks that are 100 years old in Calgary. Most of the damage that we get from sidewalks is on the curb from cars parking alongside it, and those tires erode away the sidewalk over time, as well as shovels. But part of their concerns is the freeze-thaw cycles. with sidewalks and the way that that expands and contracts. And in Calgary, we get Chinooks. Like, we move pretty quick from a freeze to a thaw and then back to a freeze. So we can get these wild temperature swings. And so these students have been experimenting and have done some adding of graphene into the concrete mix used for our sidewalks here. And they're finding that it's more durable and more water resistant, and it's better for the environment because concrete is a huge, huge producer of CO2. Mm-hmm. So this could be actually some pretty, pretty good news. So we'll see. We'll see what comes of this, but it's an interesting local solution. And I think this is one of the biggest things with urbanism, that it's important to have local solutions because the people in the area know the area and have some insight on what we can do better. So that's my quick story. I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that or not. So, speak now or forever hold your peace.
I just think that's really cool. Like, for mm-hmm. people to experiment with this, and this is how innovation happens, right? Just random yeah. little thing. Nobody thinks like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a concrete expert, or, you know, I'm going to do yeah. a project about concrete. And I just love it when people come out like this, engineering mm-hmm. students. They always yeah. have the coolest ideas. And I think that's where a lot of innovation happens. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Well, I hope this goes somewhere. And that's all about I can say about it is that I hope it does help. I hope it's better.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Sammy, any thoughts on sidewalks?
Every time I think or hear about concrete, I only think about how Rome lost the recipe to concrete. And then 500 years later, we come up with worse concrete than they had. Yeah.
I love call it worse concrete, yet it's only because we've been driving on it. If we drove on Roman roads, they'd be screwed.
Well, they invented like regenerating concrete hundreds of years ago, and then we just rediscovered it. Yeah. And then it's like, oh shoot.
Yeah.
Look, it was that easy.
We just have to put like limestone water in there.
Romans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. That's something we should talk about on the show. We should do like a history of sidewalks, huh? How about that?
You're making me think of that post. It's like this Twitter post where someone said, like, or no, it was like a Reddit post where someone unironically asked, where was all the chariot parking for the Colosseum?
They had a little underground parkade for all the chariots, everybody arriving by chariot. That'd be pretty good, actually. This is why, you guys, we've been building cities without cars forever. We just got to keep doing it. Let's get into listener mail, though. Sammy, we're going to let you read Jen Hall's comment, friend of the show. If you want to jump on there, if you see that on the sheet, it's listener mail number one.
Yes. Jen says, there are so many styles of cargo bikes. What are your personal favorites and what would you haul on them? Example. Utility, John, long John, cycle truck, long tail. I don't know what the last one is.
Box feet. Box bike.
Box bike.
Yeah.
Well,
bike
I'm
with big box.
I'm ready for this one.
Okay, go, Nick.
My favorite type are definitely long tail cargo bikes.
Mm.
I don't have one yet, but it's like definitely on the tip of my mind. Like, I'm always like, yeah, you know what? I think I can get one. Like, I don't need it. I don't need it.
And yeah.
I just keep toying with the idea. But if I'm going to get an e-bike and a cargo bike at that, it's definitely going to be long tail. And I think a lot of them are very versatile, especially the box bike can be very versatile. But the thing about the box bike is, well, it has a huge cargo capacity. You can carry tons in it. You can carry like two people in it. It's fantastic. But it's like having the pickup truck for everything. It can be overkill for a lot of trips. While the actual long tail, you could just use it as a regular bike. And granted, they're going to be really heavy and it is still a bit overkill, but you could take off a lot of the stuff and then you just have this long platform in the back of it. But that's what I really love is that long tail on the back. That platform is super versatile. You can change it up easily, put on different accessories. You can make it a seat for 2 to 3 children. You can just put boxes on the back just for cargo capacity. I love them so much.
Yeah. Amen. I actually think I'm going to have to agree with you. Like you said, like a full cargo bike, like a bucket bike, with the bin in front is great. Like if you've got, kids, I think that's a great way to get around a little more comfortably. But yeah, it's the width. Like, I feel like that's so much harder to lock up, especially if your area doesn't have good cycling parking. Yeah, the width really, really kills it for me. So I'm gonna say long tail as well.
The buck feats is really, I would say it's an indicator species of good cycling infrastructure. And in that as well, too, I think it kind of limits its use, especially in North America, with mm-hmm. where you can really take it. Like, don't get me wrong, I'd love to be able to move a washing machine with my bike. But, like, let's be realistic here. I'm not going to be able to use that for most trips. I think I'd take a long tail any day. There are some really great long tails out there. I actually do have a utility right now, and it's good. It's just a little limited compared to a long tail, where you can have that ability to have a second passenger on board. You can really haul a lot more stuff, and it really kind of fits that, like, hybrid. I would almost say it's kind of like the SUV or like the minivan of the bike world, where it's really good for that kind of like versatile use, but like isn't so limited like a pickup truck would be. And I'd probably have to go with the long tail. As much as I like the utilities are good, but I feel like they're a little limited in their use when it comes to like having like bigger cargo or like a passenger or anything like that. And yeah, that's why I'd go with the long tail.
Yeah. You got thoughts on this, Ethan?
Or Sammy? I just had to Google all the bikes. Sure. I was like, what are all these? I was like, you guys should pull them up as we're speaking. So, you know, you should make a versus. You know, like a versus
ooh,
back.
Ooh, like
back,
a, yeah.
For sidewalks.
Yeah, we could do
tournament. March Madness. Yeah.
Yeah.
I looked through them. The long tail seems the most normal bike-esque bike.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other one, the cycle trek or the long john? That looks like a long tail, but in reverse. So.
Okay. I don't know. Let me look up the long john. I don't actually know. Long John bike. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually, one I kind of think would be cool. I think it'd be cool to have like a little ice cream bike. Have like the freezer in the front.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, isn't that just what a Long John is, but with a freezer on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
A Long John is like a box bike.
Yeah.
It's very similar.
It's very, yeah. I'd say the box bike is a little bit more ergonomic and like aerodynamic, but
so
just generally in shape, because it's got that bucket shape rather than that like strict, like kind of like rigid shape. But yeah, I mean, it feels a little more limited too.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So which one are you going with, Sammy?
Long tail. I'll bandwagon right now.
Oh, yeah. Long tail wins. I'll be curious what people in the comments think, which, by the way, if you want to comment on this video, you can do that on YouTube. We post it there. You can also send us an email at radiofreeurbanism@gmail.com. Ethan's got our next comment here from Pai Kiwika. I asked them how to pronounce
a more frequent name. User too, as well, or mm-hmm. fan of the show.
Yeah.
Pai Kiwika. I think. All right. Yeah. All right. We're working on it, folks. But the comment said, I think one of the major differences between an airplane and car crashes is that nearly everybody can operate a car, which creates infinitely more opportunities for something to go wrong. Trains and buses are like planes in that not everyone can drive them, but ironically, because trains and buses don't fly, they sometimes collide with cars. Cars are nearly always the problem. Paint, bollards, barricades, and signs aren't enough to prevent collisions. Only getting people out of cars will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's a great point. And that's the problem, right, is we allow so many people to drive cars, and not only allow them, but require them to drive cars in so many places. And again, going back to Japan, getting your license is a lot more work, not only a lot more work in studying and actual exams, driving exams that you have to do, it's very expensive compared to North America, where, you know, here in Canada, it's not more than a few hundred dollars to get your license. There, it's thousands of dollars before you can get in your car and start driving. Yep. So we need much better infrastructure for people to live in their environment, but also we need more stringent tests and regulations when it comes to getting a license.
Also, yeah. Don't yeah, underestimate not- drivers, because there have been plane on car collisions in the past. Do not underestimate drivers. They are impressive they at will, crashing into everything.
They will find a way to make it happen. I think this is a great point. And I think when we're talking about fewer people being allowed to drive, we don't mean like we should just like bar people from driving. We mean we should make you actually have to go through a challenge in order to drive. Like, you should actually have to learn how to drive.
The Canada's worst
in
driver.
In order to drive. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like the fact that we can have a show called Canada's Worst Driver is a perfect illustration of the point. Our worst driver should still be a safe driver and a responsible driver.
Yeah, I think it's weird. Like Toronto, most people in Toronto at the age of 28, 30, 40, whatever, a lot of them don't even have their driver's license. Even though Toronto's public transit isn't the best compared to other big cities. It goes back to that thing. It was like, we can prevent people from driving. We should do that by public transit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just give people options, give people a multitude of ways to get around and let them choose whichever way they'd like to get around, whether that's cycling, walking, driving, train, bus, whatever. Right. I think those options are key. I'm going to read our next comment here. This one is an email. Again, you can email us at radiofreeurbanism@gmail.com. And this one comes in from Raphael. And he says, I've lived car-free for over 3 years now, but I occasionally drive 2 or 3 times per year when I need to. Since I used to own a car for several years straight, I usually feel pretty comfortable driving. But since I recently drove on a high-speed Strode, which made me feel afraid for the first time, at first I thought I may be losing my skills and confidence. But now that I think about it, it's the high-speed traffic I felt forced to keep up with that made me afraid. I don't ever want to own a car again, yet I want to still be able to drive. But I feel like not putting in the time to drive will leave me unable to deal with the difficult traffic situations. I'd like to ask you, as car-free urbanists, to share what it's like when you drive. So that's like a really interesting question. Who here is car-free? Okay, so Ethan and I are car-free. So we'll kick Nick and Sammy off of the show. We'll see you next week after you sell your car.
I'm in farmland, man. It took me 30 minutes to even get to the city.
You should have to walk.
Clearly what Alex wants you to do following his article.
Yeah, according to that Calgary Herald commenters, I want everybody to be car-free, even farmers, obviously. You should be able to harvest your crops from a bicycle. let's hear from Ethan first on this. Ethan, how often do you end up driving?
So I actually don't have a license, crazily enough.
Oh, really?
Okay. I don't drive at all. Literally, if I have to get anywhere, I will carpool. And I've just never had the urge to have a license. Like, I will get incredibly anxious behind the wheel. And personally, I don't feel safe enough to drive when I'm operating a vehicle, nor do I feel like I'm, you know, having any passengers on board be safe. So I just don't feel comfortable operating an automobile, and that's just my feeling.
Interesting. Okay. Sammy, how often do you drive?
Every day.
You gotta drive every day, yeah.
And if I won't go to the gym, it's a 20-minute drive for me.
Boo. All
right. Just go outside. The gym's free. Run.
Yeah. So obviously, like, your living situation requires that.
Yeah.
That you have a car. Like,
that's, I don't
own
my own car. I just fam car.
Car. Oh, okay.
We have one car, two cars.
Yeah.
But for like 15 years, we only had one car amongst 4 people. And then we would just,
Oh, really? Yeah. So you made it work, right? And you kind of planned a little bit differently. Nick, you've got a car.
I do.
How often do you drive?
Very rarely. Like as you guys were talking, I'm like, when was the last time I drove? And personally drove, I think back in March, maybe March, you know, it was February. I remember my friend wanted a ride to the airport and I was going to say, why don't you just take transit? But I think he just wanted to have a chat with me. So I was like, you know what? I'll pick you up, drop you off at the airport. I think that was the last time I personally drove. But as for Raphael's question about dealing with those situations, it can be harrowing sometimes, you know, when you don't drive very often. I only drive, like, again, maybe once a month at most, if that, personally. But virtual reality. It's simulators.
you do a lot of driving sims and stuff?
Well, no, not anymore. But I was into, like, sim racing for a little while with the wheel and everything. But one of my favorite games, and this is hilarious, but is actually Euro Truck Simulator. So you're like in a big rig in VR, just like listen to a podcast, driving around Europe. It's fantastic. So I actually got a lot of practice driving on the left side of the road, which actually prepared me for doing it in the real world, which I have done. So it was easy. I was like, yeah, I've done this before. It's fine.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Nice.
Yeah. Despite all the car hate, do you guys enjoy driving? Like,
I love driving. Okay. I actually sincerely find it a pleasure behind the wheel. I know, like, Raphael's talking about, like, the, you know, being nervous and driving on this road and the high speeds and stuff. So the last time I drove, I think it was a couple months ago. My brother lent me his car. We were hanging out and I had to go somewhere right after. And I felt fine. It was on winter roads. I was more cautious. And of course, being so into urbanism and stuff, I was thinking more about, like, what I was doing and my speed and where I am and, you know, the way I'm checking around and stuff. My brother's car is horrible for blind spots. And then in the summer, the last time I drove before that was probably almost 6 months. It was August in the summer. I was doing landscaping. My boss was away, so I would bike to his house and I'd pick up his truck. And I'd drive around with some mowers and stuff and go and do my landscaping job all day around the city. I felt fine about it. More aware, of course, but I like driving. Like, I enjoy it. So although I'm more aware of things, it's not as anxiety inducing for me.
Compared to biking.
Compared to biking, well, depending on the cycling infrastructure,
yeah.
I find it's
all a context.
I find driving is like the only activity most people do day to day, unless if you're blasting a bunch of like music and singing along. But if you're not listening to anything, probably the only time where people aren't being distracted, like if they're just in like autopilot driving, you know, they're just kind of like.
You underestimate kind of people's ability to use their phones.
Yeah, while driving, that's so true. But like on average, that's the one time I find where I'm like kind of like in my, I can think to myself.
You're in the zone.
Most of the time it's just doom scrolling on Instagram.
Doom
scrolling reels behind the wheel.
Oh man. I do enjoy driving. I like road trips. That's a big thing for me. That's why I say, like, if I was rich, I'd probably have a car. Like I wouldn't use it as much because I'd have 100 e-bikes. but like I'd probably have a car too. Let's give this to Nick here with our next comment.
Yeah, this one's from Austin, and he's talking about Las Vegas. So yeah, he says, brief thoughts of Las Vegas. He stayed in the Fremont area for almost a week. Drivers, generally chill to bike around, even in the mega strodes like the Boulder Highway. Lots of cars running red lights. Transit, weirdly militant security that inspects every bus at certain stops. Reasonably priced, good frequencies besides the hourly. What's CX?
Century Express.
The only bus to serve Terminal 3. In cycling, bike lanes everywhere, mostly painted, not protected, but still better than nothing. Some good pathways with bridges over major roads.
Yeah, that's Austin's report from Vegas. Ethan, I'm wondering if you have any commentary on this.
I've actually never seen the security patrols on RTC buses, which is our local bus service. So maybe that's just something within the Fremont area, just because I know that generally security is a little more concerned with safety over towards Fremont and the east side of town. Just generally not my neighborhood and its routes. Yeah, transit's pretty reasonably priced here. You can get a day pass for $5. So I'd say that's pretty accurate. The drivers, weirdly patient with pedestrians. But yeah, I have seen a lot of incidences of running red lights and plenty of reckless driving. That's just something that happens out here. You get a lot of people going crazy on vacation too. But even locals, you know, will still go crazy because, I mean, there's really nothing better to do when it becomes to like being a local and like finding hobbies. Car culture is really something that gets built up in areas without transit. Cycling. Yeah, I'd have to agree. There are a lot of painted bike lanes, especially. I will say that one thing about Vegas that's weird, I've said it before on the podcast, and I'm sure Austin can agree with me here, is that the infrastructure gets better the more you're getting out of Vegas. So the further away you get from the Strip in downtown, the better the infrastructure gets. You run into less sharrows and painted bike lanes and more actual like multi-purpose trails and stuff like that, which is it's very different than a lot of other cities. But I mean, it's just a weird quirk of living here.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's kind of, you know, you'd think that that the Strip would have some nice infrastructure, maybe even a bike share.
We do have a bike share.
Oh, do you?
So the area he was staying in, Fremont, actually does have bike share. It's really affordable, surprisingly. I think a full year pass for it is like $25 or something like that. It's really cheap.
Okay, but, really good.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I mean, like, there's not a whole ton of stations. It's mostly concentrated around downtown. Mm-hmm. But I know that they have taken an effort to expanding it. I still need to go try it out myself. I haven't actually ridden on any of the bikes, mostly because it's just in downtown and I don't go downtown very often, but it is something that is pretty exciting for Vegas just to have, especially in its downtown area where, you know, those last mile trips can really be made by bike. But yeah, the buses are fairly frequent out here and it's pretty affordable. I do have my gripes with RTC and on time and reliability, but a lot of that also comes to just not really investing in transit out here. But, you know, for a car-centric city, it's not the worst that you can deal with. It's not the worst.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, well, that's informative. And people are wondering why Austin didn't use the bike share while he was there. Well, it's because Austin is one of the people who puts his bike on the airplane and takes it with him when he travels. He biked from Vegas down to the Hoover Dam. How serious. How serious Austin is.
I rented a car and did that.
Yeah. And I remember when I was there as a kid driving from Vegas to the Hoover Dam. I felt like it was a long trip. I was like, wow, this is a ways away. But Austin biked that. So
45 minute drive? Nah. We can make this a few hours on the trails.
Austin texted me his little Strava thing. It was 6.5 hours round trip for him.
Wow.
It's a way to see Vegas for sure. I'll say
good for
that
him.
It's great. So I always appreciate getting Austin's comments because he knows bikes. That's what he does. As we wrap up the show, I wanna chat with Sammy a little bit more than about Untitled Planning and maybe tell people like some stuff you've got coming up.
Before, can I ask Nick a question about biking infrastructure in Vancouver? I was in Vancouver over the summer, last summer. Your bike system, you guys just leave bikes in the middle of nowhere? This is what I've noticed. No?
Bikes, what do you mean?
The bike share.
Like the bike share?
Typically, no. Usually they're docked.
I was in North Vancouver. There's just like...
Oh, yeah. North Vancouver has Lime bike shares. They're all over the place. And they have the scooters,
they're
too.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, it's a problem.
I was just walking. It's like under a tree in the middle of a forest. I was like, who left this here?
Yeah, it's in Richmond, too. Yeah, I don't often visit North Vancouver, so
yeah.
I don't see it so often. But yeah, they do that.
If your city has Lime, you're going to find a scooter in an odd place. It's just it's just how it is.
I am a firm believer in docking. docking your bikes. I am a firm believer in docking your bikes. Let me just get the full sentence out all at once.
People need not apply. Sorry, bad joke. Yeah, you're so innocent, Alex.
I don't know.
Oh God. Okay.
Maybe I did it on purpose.
Back on track.
This is already
back on track.
A crazy turn for the podcast.
Okay. Tell us about untitled planning, Sammy.
I've got a question for Sammy. I think we can. Can I start there? Because I've been burning. I want to ask this question. So, it's a term that I only heard from going onto your YouTube channel recently, and I want to hear you talk about it. So, what is creative mixed use, and why should we care about it?
It's great. Go watch my YouTube video on creative mixed use. I did the voiceover. Alex did amazing editing. Creative mixed use. Do you guys know what mixed use is overall?
Tell us what mixed use is for those who don't know.
So mixed use, even though it's been around for hundreds of years, I feel, and back, you know, like even when I was a kid in the Middle East, I would see mixed use. You'd have this apartment building at the bottom. You'd have a baker and be like, wow, that's just a normal building. And you come to North America and it's single family house, office building. They're not mixed together. And you're like, why? Why is this not together? Mm-hmm. But mixed use is basically taking two things and putting it together for space efficiency, but it also creates a greater probability of having community. So that's kind of what mixed use is. So you might have stores at the bottom, housing on top. I think where creative mixed use comes in, I think this term is kind of led by the Infrastructure Institute in the University of Toronto. That's where Alex works. Not this Alex, my...
Not my, this Alex.
Yeah. Yeah.
Untitled Planet is Alex.
And their kind of approach is finding creative spaces and putting them together. Housing with a fire station. I know that's a thing in Vancouver. Affordable housing mixed with a fire station. They've done studies. It works. I know people are like, what about the noise? Well, my one friend had a good comment to me about that. And they're like, what happens if some idiot just parks right in front of the fire station? And they're trying to visit someone in the house. I'm like, that's a valid statement. I don't know. Mixing public transit with a library. And so you have a transit station where buses can come through. But you also have a library. When Alex is on this podcast, she did a lot of the research. She did a full gallery. We actually did this little montage of the gallery that she had, and had a bunch of models and a bunch of images. And it's really, really cool, but it's also it's really important moving forward, because there's literally no reason. No one can find me a reason on why we shouldn't mix buildings together. You know, it's like, why do we need individual buildings? It drives me I know Nick's seen this, and anyone that's been in a suburb, but in London, nothing drives me more crazy. I drive by and there's blocks, you know, the box stores, hundreds of box stores, it's a 10-minute drive and just box store after box store. But there's so much space that you can build on these box stores. But right after the box store is a brand new suburb. I'm like, why? Why would you do this? Why not just build an apartment on top of this, on top of Marx, you know? Marx does not need to be standing alone.
No.
And then as well, you can build in the parking lot, because the parking lot is bigger than the building itself.
And if you have housing on these box buildings, you don't even need much parking, because most people are living in that area.
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah.
Your customers were there.
Man. And so,
yeah.
And so essentially, though, creative, I don't know if you want to go into the whole also 15-minute city thing. I don't, have you guys gone through that stuff before? The conspiracy?
Yeah. I've been stuck in the goop.
Yeah. It's crazy. I'm 50, the 15-minute city thing. I don't even know how it became a conspiracy theory, because the whole time we study good city planning, it's just dense cities. It's having everything where you need it to be. In a walking environment. And then they threw a term in there, and they're like, oh, let's call it 15-minute neighborhood community. And then someone threw in the term city, and people lost their minds. They're like, oh my God, we're about to enter communism. Yeah. I'm like,
you are literally entering a surveillance state. You will have no freedom. Eat the bug. Yeah, all that.
I was like, how did that all come together? I'm like, sure, you have some crazy dictator that comes along and does that. You know, he might do that to you. But, you know, dense and active and walkable cities have been a thing forever. Yep. Old Europe, old Middle East. I don't know, like Montreal, Vancouver.
Yeah.
But the suburbs, man. Not the suburbs.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of that's a bit about creative mixed use.
Do you have any follow-up questions, Nick?
No. That's great.
Thank you. I want to rant.
Yeah. rants are welcome here.
Absolutely.
Tell us like what more do you do and where can we find you?
So Untitled Planning, find us on YouTube, find us on our website, untitledplanning.com or .ca leads you to the same place. And Instagram, Twitter. We're most active Instagram, YouTube. And that's where you find us. Upcoming content. We interviewed two separate psychologists. Well, one a neuroscientist at the University of Waterloo. And that's a really interesting conversation. We looked at the intersections between planning and architecture, but through the lens of the psychology. And then we did a follow-up interview, not with him, but another psychologist who's a practicing psychologist, and she's doing her PhD at the University of Toronto. But we looked at the intersection, the same intersection, but through how the physical environment, the shapes and the lines and the contours kind of impact that perception as well. So it's a little bit two different angles, and so that's interesting. We also have another interview coming out looking at AI and planning and how that's going to change the planning process a bit. If people know, the planning process can take forever. You like submit an application.
Yeah.
2 years later, they tell you, edit this three words, and then you resubmit the application, and then you get no developments, and it's very frustrating. I'm over-exaggerating a bit. I know someone's going to call me out. Like, not really.
The bureaucracy can...
And a lot of it's like something that you'll hear about it in the interview, but like something that might take a planner like 5 hours, it might take them an hour with some of the AI stuff because you don't have to do all the bone breaking tedious tasks. Then we got a few other interesting things coming. We got I don't know if it's too early to announce, but we've been working on this since we essentially started Untitled Planning, but we have what we're calling a multimedia connect to planning. And so there's like pop culture club, book club, literature review club. That's all coming. I don't know when you guys are launching this, but if this is tomorrow, then it's a real early announcement. Real early.
It's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. It's real early.
And guess what? It's in like 3 hours for our patrons you can go and support Radio Free Urbanism and get a whole bunch of other benefits. Join now.
Don't worry. We're building the fan base now. So like we're building the hype. People are going to be ready for it now.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have videos coming. It's going to be really interesting. Maybe I'll give a little bit of a tidbit about that or a bit of a background context behind that. So we have like three pillars with Untitled Planning. You guys can tell me to stop talking whenever. I'll just keep on talking.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
So we kind of have like three main pillars with Untitled Planning. With the media stuff, at least, or like the reasoning behind it. And the first was like the action-based knowledge mobilization. Like people need to know what they can do. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, there's a lot of professionals in the world, like not even in planning, but in the world, urbanism or architecture or nutrition and business. I see this all the time. They're hella rusty. They're like very, very rusty. And they start talking about really outdated stuff. This is very common in science. You have like scientists that are saying things are outdated. But I feel like it's probably a bit common in planning too, that they're not up to date with like maybe some of the literature. They're not up to date with some of the up and coming kind of people that are coming up or professors and organizations. And so we want to kind of make sure people within that kind of lane, they can stay a bit fresh, you know, not spew as much nonsense.
Right.
This is in general, I don't know. And then the third kind of encompasses all of that on behalf of Alex and myself and the people involved. It's so we can stay fresh as professionals and planners, because we didn't want to just go down the route of a 9-to-5 and not kind of stay interested in what's going on. And so that's kind of why we're introducing this kind of multimedia connect club.
I like it.
Nice.
Yeah, I dig that. So we're gonna put links for all your stuff in the show notes, and I'll put a little tag thing beside your name with the at Untitled Planning stuff. Ethan, where can we find you?
Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone, you can find me at Climate in Transit on most social media platforms, except for Twitter. You can find me at @ClimateTransit. Nick, where can we find you?
I'm at Nick Laporte on YouTube or Nick the Door in other places. How about Alex? Where can we find you?
You can find me at Humane Cities on Instagram and YouTube. I just made a little note in the thing that's got us chuckling. But you can find me at Humane Cities. I'll hopefully have a video out soon. Right now I'm just like hyper focused on this RCG upzoning. So I'm going to give another plug for that. If you want to help Calgary be a more resilient city, send me a message and I'll let you know how you can help. So with that, folks, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining, folks. And as always, train good and car bad.
Two wheels good.
And feet first. Sammy, do you have a little tag you want to say? One pithy, quick little note for the good people at home?
Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys. Thank you for I don't know. Perfect. I didn't.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. For more episodes, find us on your favorite podcatcher or on YouTube at Radio Free Urbanism.